This is Side Hustle with Luke and Omar. We'll explore what it takes to run a side hustle with talented individuals from different backgrounds and experiences. We will discuss things like taking the plunge, personal challenges, and the balancing act of maintaining a day job whilst side hustling to make the dream a reality. Now sit back, relax, as we talk to some of these amazing individuals. Hey everyone, welcome back for another episode of Side Hustle. Today we have a special guest, Joe Romeo, and my co-host, Luke.
Hey guys.
How's it going?
Good, good. Had a good break over the new year. Great. Taj, ready to come back. I'm just happy to be back.
It's episode one, is it? New season?
Pretty much, yeah.
It's the first episode of the first year.
All right.
Yeah. Well, the first recording, we're not sure what's coming out yet because we had two banked up from last year. And actually, we listened to one of them and we clearly say... I say I need a break. So it was clearly December last year. But yeah, it'll come out sometime.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Joe, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us have a chat. Obviously, we've been talking for quite some time and we're glad that finally our schedules align. So we're very grateful that you can give up some of your Friday evening to come and sit down and talk to Luke and myself.
Definitely.
Would love to get an idea of obviously just your profession and what you're currently doing, and then we'll slowly start getting into your side hustle and kind of your upbringing and background of that.
So I'm currently employed at Airwallex. I'm a digital marketing manager with a specialty in SEO.
Mm-hmm.
So I've basically been doing SEO ever since I was in university and since I finished, and it was actually something I fell into, and now I've been working at it full time for ever since. So SEO or Airwallex mainly is a international payments platform. So it's a way for you to be able to send money overseas at really good rates, but it's really business to business.
Okay.
So it's kind of in the startup phase now. It's been there for about 4 years.
Sure.
And we're really starting to roll on and trying to get some traction here in Australia.
Okay, how does SEO kind of fuel their growth or their awareness? Because it's not a business-to-consumer type company. It's business-to-business. So how do you kind of go about creating that strategy for them?
A lot of it comes down to the right type of research. You need to make sure that we're targeting the right type of keywords, so business-focused keywords rather than consumer-focused keywords.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be producing a lot of content that's business-orientated, a lot of business advice, essentially, and that's a good way for people to find out about us that necessarily didn't know that we existed, which is something that we have only been around for the last 4 years or so.
Sure.
So, yeah, really a good content-led strategy and looking at, like, some really strong business articles and ways to find people in that fashion seem to be working really well.
So thinking about that strategy, what does that kind of compile of? Not necessarily what the strategy is, but like the elements of the strategy. Like how does the sort of SEO come together into a strategy, I guess?
So SEO is pretty multifaceted. It's not just optimizing a website and getting it to show up for keywords. A lot of it is content-led. So producing content of what people are looking for rather than just writing a really detailed article, a really detailed post for something that doesn't necessarily have a lot of demand for it.
Sure.
We're actually demand focused. So that's really the core of where it begins. So that might be, for example, with us, we're looking at the different currencies that people are trying to send money to online from Australia, produce content around that, the nuances around that particular currency, how long it takes, what are the fees associated with that, what are the things you have to consider. Like, for example, if you're sending money into China, you need to be able to produce like a legal document to say this is what it's for, just a lot of things like that, and it seems to be working really well.
Yeah, awesome. So does that also align with like the product sort of roadmap as well? Like do you guys kind of work... like you see what's coming new feature-wise and then write content knowing what's coming out sort of thing? Or how does that sort of have a nuance together?
Yeah, so we work closely with the product team. At the moment, we're working on a Xero integration, the accounting software.
Yeah.
So just a bit of background, we're actually working really well with SMEs and small businesses here in Australia. And we found that through our research that Xero is the main accounting platform. And that was actually a big barrier for small to medium-sized businesses for using us.
Sure.
So we basically created an app that's going to be able to integrate with Xero so you can import all your transactions. And
Awesome.
And that's kind of led a lot of the content in terms of the next couple of months anyway, because we're about to hit the roadshow for that.
Okay. That sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Talk us through your side hustle.
So my side hustle is a Aperitif agency, and I've had that running for the last 4 years. And essentially, it's an SEO and SEM agency for small to medium enterprises.
Okay.
My background was working with small to medium businesses pretty much ever since I've worked through uni. And there was a lot there that I learned that I could apply into these types of businesses from an enterprise level as well, that I thought here's a bit of a gap here. Mm-hmm. A lot of people seem to approach small to medium enterprises as like everything's a nail and I'm a hammer, you know, like let's give everyone the same treatment, even though their needs are quite unique.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've had that run for the last 4 years.
Your side hustle is pretty much the same as what you do in your 9-to-5. So essentially you can use your 9-to-5 to practice and then feed it through your side hustle.
The skill set is the same.
Yeah.
There's obviously some main differences being like budget constraints, particularly with small businesses in comparison to working with a $1 billion company.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to pick the highlights and what's going to have the biggest impact for the minimum amount of resources.
Yeah.
And basically help small to medium businesses grow.
Right. And I'm assuming there's no conflict of interest, obviously, because it's literally you're doing the same thing.
Yeah, but Airwallex doesn't have clients that we offer SEO to. I only do SEO for our own internal brands as a way.
So that's kind of the differentiating factor.
Yeah, so I'm not necessarily competing with Airwallex. I'm just using the same skill set.
Cool. And how long have you been doing your side thing for?
It's been about 4 years now.
4 years. Okay. Yeah. Talk us through the start, man. How did it all come together?
The gap that you mentioned, like how'd you seize that gap and find that gap?
Sure. So the start was almost by accident. Like I wasn't really planning to start Aperitif just like, oh, I wrote a business plan and this is what I wanted to do.
Sorry, I'm just going to interfere in here. Aperitif?
Yes.
How did that come about?
Long story, but I really I just have a inkling for old aperitif brands like Campari and Cinzano and stuff like that. And I've actually shared some ideas with Luke. I just really love that kind of era in like the 80s, 70s, 80s and 90s with these old advertisements. And
oh, cool.
Kind of started from there.
Like the typography, the tone and the look and feel.
The imagery, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
It kind of stemmed from there. And I thought it was a unique name that no one would be using for a digital agency. So I kind of ran with that.
Nice. All right, cool.
Yeah.
Sorry, back to where you were.
I actually kind of fell on it by... I left an agency at the time and I had a client hit me up and be like, look, I want to keep working with you. So I didn't have a non-compete at the time. So he ended up coming on board and I just started off doing some freelance with him directly.
So you had just finished a job and a client that you were servicing at the time, you left that job and they were still keen to kind of hire you for your services.
That's it.
Yeah, okay. Awesome.
Build up a good relationship with him over about a year and a half to 2 years. His name's Alex, by the way. If you're listening, I'm sure he will tune in.
Shout out to Alex.
And we ended up working together for just doing some freelance and then it kind of built from word of mouth to a decent sized portfolio, and now it's just basically building on that way. So at the moment I don't do any paid or lead acquisition or anything like that. All my clients have come from referrals.
Yep.
And I think that's just a testament to you actually putting the effort in building a relationship with the clients and doing work that makes a difference. And like it's probably the best way that you know that you're doing a good job is if they're going to refer someone else for the same thing.
Definitely.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, definitely. So we touched on before, I guess, your profession and your freelance or your business is the same thing, your side hustle.
Mm-hmm.
How do you use your day-to-day, like your salary job, to help fuel that, the desire to keep wanting to do that after hours as well? Like you're kind of doing I do the same thing too. I design like for work and for after hours.
Yeah.
So I understand from my point of view how this question works. But from your point of view, how does that sort of translate through and have the motivation to keep going and keep doing the similar type work, I guess?
The motivation?
Yeah.
The motivation, I think, will come from when I was a lot younger. I was just starting off at like 12, 13 years old. Always came from, I wouldn't say an entrepreneurial family, but my parents and my grandparents and everything always self-employed, always had their own businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was instilled in me from then.
What sort of businesses did they have?
To be honest, very different from SEO.
Okay.
Like I grew up in essentially a working class family.
I'm assuming SEO didn't exist back then.
It definitely didn't exist back then. Sorry. A bit of background, my grandparents are Italian migrants.
Mm-hmm.
And when they moved to Australia, they did a lot of manual work. Let's say start off in factory work and stuff like that.
Mm.
So you have big language barriers, all they knew, then ended up doing farming.
Yep.
Okay.
And ended up in the fruit and veg trade. My stepdad is like owns a fruit and veg store as well now.
Yeah, wow.
But what, something that he instilled with us was, from a young age, was hard work and work for yourself, because then you're in control of your own destiny, rather than always having to work for someone else and always
answer for someone else.
Yeah, yep. Exactly right.
Yep.
So yeah, he always had us working at a young age. I think I started working at like 12 or 13 years old, helping out in markets and stuff like that, getting to work with customers, getting to speak to people. A lot of manual work as well. I actually worked on a potato farm too at one point.
Yeah, cool.
Anything that we could do at that time, like at 13 years old, to get like a decent salary after school, like it was pretty cool.
And what were you doing with that money at the time?
To be honest, like my parents made me save a lot of it.
Okay.
They took a chunk of it and put it in the bank for us and made sure that we're saving some. But I bought, when at the time you could start driving in SA at 16 and a half. So when I was 16 and a half, I bought myself a car. And like, I was just proud that it was something that I saved up for. My first car was a VZ Commodore.
A VZ Commodore? What's a VZ? Is that like a VZ. Sedan? Or
sedan, yeah.
Okay.
Holden Commodore.
Okay.
Yeah. Back then, I thought it was the coolest thing. Now, if I see myself driving it, I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I'm going to have to Google that. I remember the VL. Sorry. I remember the VL, but I don't remember the VZ.
VL was a lot older than the VZ, I think, at the time. Yeah, so I think it might be a few years younger than you lads, but like at that time, I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, awesome.
There's some interesting similarities between us on that level. Like my dad didn't work for himself. He worked for the council, but he employed me when I was 13.
Oh, nice.
So I worked with him like all the way until I got a part-time job. And thinking about the parallel between your profession and your freelance, your agency, and how they sort of correlate, and the word of mouth, mine's very similar as well. And I was just thinking about it today, and I realized, I think I use my salary job as a network. Like my salary job is me flexing, showing what I can do, learning everything.
It's a living portfolio.
Pretty much. And then when I leave a job, it's like all these people who saw what I could do then hit me up for like their startups or startups that they know, and or that I get my freelance through that.
Yeah.
And just it's sort of, I guess it sounds like it rings true to you as well, of that hard work sort of pays off because people see what you did. And then
that almost sounds like a live letter of resignation from your 9 to 5.
Eventually. My dream, I had one bucket list thing was to be made redundant one day. That's done. We actually went through that together, Joe and I. And another bucket list I have, and this is not about my current job, but just in general, is to one day just be like, fuck it, I'm out.
Yeah.
I want to do that one day.
Yeah. The table flip and you walk out the door. Yeah, for sure. I can't wait to do that either.
Yeah.
Joe, talk us through some of your childhood experiences in terms of kind of working for yourself. What did that mean? Did you like it? Did you dislike it? Just kind of the mental state that you were at the time, because obviously being at such a young age and being told to go work for your own money, it's not what normal kids do these days.
Yeah, it's true. And at the time, my parents made it sound like that was the normal thing to do.
Because of their upbringing, I'm assuming, and where they came from.
Because that's what they did.
Yeah.
But yeah, at the time, it was pretty tough the first couple of years. Like the markets were on Sunday mornings, and my stepdad used to get me up and my brother as well and pull us into the truck at like 4 a.m. in the morning.
Yep.
Be in there freezing cold, no air conditioner in the truck, and winds blowing in through the windows.
To set up the market stall.
You'd get there for like a 6 a.m. start, but you have to go there and set everything up, and it was just like setting up crates, like very manual, getting on the truck, pulling off the boxes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And
was it just you, or did you have
me, my younger brother? So he was even younger than me when we started, really.
Yeah, wow.
So 3 years apart, he would have been 10.
Wow.
And my grandparents as well. And the reason they used to bring us along is because me and my brother could jump up on the truck and pull off the heavy stuff and leave because they were old, you know.
They probably had like knee and like lower back problems and stuff.
Yeah. And at the time, like we'd do all this work and you'd finish at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon and like, here's $30. And I'm like, man, like this sucks.
Oh, so $30.
That wasn't much money for that amount of work.
We kind of had an inkling.
Yeah,
okay. There was a lot of hours, and like in the summer it sucked as well. Like in South Australia, it's really hot. You know, it's like 37 degrees.
Yeah,
you're outside, like sun's beating down on you. That was pretty crappy.
Was there also work for you guys to get the fruit and the vegetables into the boxes, like the cleaning it and all that sort of process, or was that already done
before? Nah, that was already done. It kind of came in boxes already and we just had to put it on display. But the best thing about it is we got to learn how to speak to people. Like we're 12, 13 years old serving adults.
Mm.
So we kind of grew up a lot younger than we did. from a working perspective, but even just from a life perspective as well. So just a bit of background, like my parents split when I was five. And my mum for a few years pretty much raised me and my brother on her own for quite a few years. We ended up living with my grandparents and stuff like that.
Sure.
And then from there, like, I saw my mum struggling, and that was kind of a big motivation for, man, like, when I grow up, I want to be like a good family man. I want to be good to my family. I want to be able to provide and not have to go through or put my family through what me and my brother did when we grew up.
Yeah, well.
'Cause like I said, like, we grew up a lot younger than probably what we should have.
Yeah.
So like at 13 and stuff like that, already thinking about work and saving for a house. You know, European families always telling you need to be saving for a home at like 10 years old.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, totally. Man, I just want to go to the movies, mum. Can I just like go see a film?
And
like,
no, hey. Just European family. My mum wanted me to save for a house at like the age of 9.
Right?
Yeah, but, for sure.
You know, like, they have good intentions because they've been there and had to do things that are much more difficult. And they don't want you to go through the same struggles. So in hindsight, when you're older, you can understand about 13 years old when you're like, no, you're not going to a movie. You got to be saving that money. You're like, what?
That's bullshit. I want to be out with my friends. I want to be a kid, you know?
All your friends are doing that, you know? Yeah. Your friends are going out, like, spending all the money on, like, going forward a few years, going out on the weekend, spending money on booze and stuff like that.
Mm.
Like, yeah, we didn't really have that option. We never traveled as kids. We never, like, I didn't go overseas for the first time until I was 19.
Yeah, wow.
I was old enough to do it for myself. You know, my parents still, to this day, have never left Australia. So it's just, it was a very different time. And I think my brother and I's generation was very much like that transition period. So I think some lessons that I've learned from that as well was being able to pull in that old world experience that we had from my parents' generation and apply that to Aperitif.
Yeah.
So some of the feedback that I've had, particularly when you're working with like old people or customers older than ourselves per se, then you need to kind of have that old world mentality of customer service.
Absolutely.
Being able to build that relationship with someone, because people only want to do business with people they like at the end of the day.
Absolutely. That was something I was going to bring up, is that working at a market, you're obviously selling fruit and veg. So you're working in numbers, you're working in weight, you're taking money, you're giving change back.
Mm-hmm.
Someone might ask you a tricky question about if you've got this particular fruit, and you've got to answer it in a
on the fly.
In a way that's going to give them the right information and say, no, that's not in season, or yes, let me check. At that age, you're being tested, but I think having the confidence to do it at that age, that would have given you heaps of strength to kind of do what you're currently doing, because nothing will kind of phase you or like put you off track.
That's it.
Because you've had those lessons early on in life.
Yeah. And stemming from that, my grandfather, even to this day, always says, whatever you do, have courage, as in like you have to try new things. You have to go places you haven't been before. Like, he moved to the other side of the world to start a new life, having never have been there before. And like, I went a little bit later in my life, I moved to Melbourne, having only been here a few weekends here and there. And like, I might as well tell you that story as well. Like, I finished university in South Australia and couldn't get a job. There's not many jobs in.
What did you study in South Australia?
I studied marketing.
Okay.
Business management and marketing.
Yeah. Same here, by the way. Same degree.
Same degree.
Yeah, nice. Same degree, but from Auckland, New Zealand.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And there's just not a lot of marketing jobs in SA. No one's marketing departments in Adelaide. Not many businesses have a headquarter in Adelaide.
So. Unless you work for the government.
True. But yeah, then it might be.
Those are very hard to come by as well.
Exactly. And people hold them for 25 years. So. Very, very, very low turnover.
Yeah.
Then I just started applying for jobs in Melbourne because I have an aunt that lives here. She's like, you should try here. There's plenty of jobs. And then I got two interviews, which after months of being turned down was a godsend. So I flew down just for these two interviews, got one of them, and then moved here like the following week.
Yeah,
packed my bag up, and yeah, I was gone over a weekend and been living in Melbourne ever since.
And how long have you been here?
It'll be 4 years next month.
4 years.
Okay. Yeah.
That's the third time we said that now.
Has he? Okay, I just wanted to make sure that milestone is locked in. Because I'm pretty sure I asked it before we started the episode as well.
Yeah, he did.
For sure.
Just taking a little step back, when you think about the business marketing degree, what made you sort of decide to go in that route, like having the farming experience and like hands-on type stuff? Like what made you sort of go into a different sort of route?
I actually studied psychology first for a year. That was something that I really wanted to get into. But then from there, I moved into marketing because I thought it was a better fit for myself. And I was just always really interested in in ads, essentially, like nice glossy print ads.
Yep.
You know, in magazines particularly, that was some, I always end up collecting magazines for their ads and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there, that led me to study marketing. It was just kind of an interest at first. And just blossomed into a career.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, the ad world to me back then as well, because that's what kind of drew me to that industry, was very glamorous and kind of borderline fashion, but not, because you're still kind of creative. So you're not, for lack of better words, you're not shallow as in terms of the fashion industry. No offense to the fashion people out there. I'm in fashion as well, so I'm kind of insulting myself by default. But what I'm saying was, that was kind of that kind of blurred line, is that you can still be cool enough to mess with those, with the fashion people, but at the same time meet up with musicians and do cool, really cool creative work. I can totally identify with that too.
Yeah, and there's a really big degree of storytelling in it as well. You know, you've got someone's attention for 10 seconds. Can you tell them a story and make them like it?
For sure.
You know, like, people always see advertising as having this kind of evil, manipulative thought process behind it, but a lot of it is telling a story and like projecting an emotion.
It's setting a narrative.
Yeah.
But in good ad campaigns, I feel that if someone can describe it in their own way and the person next to them can describe it in their own way, then you've done a great job because everyone's setting their own narrative.
That's what makes it so interesting for me anyway.
So think about that story. So think about the story and the 10 seconds to get it or interpret it. So you think about like a movie, and then from the movie they create a world and they can create a prequel or a sequel, whatever. Mm-hmm. So when you're crafting these stories, is it, so beyond that 10 second window, how far either side does it go? Like, is there a process where the story sort of starts at one point? I'm doing this thing with things in my hands, you guys can't see that. Starts at one point and then goes, there's the ad, and then there's the end of the ad. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, is there a bit of a linear process to it? Like, how does that story work, I guess?
I think the process pulls in your own experiences and memories and the way that you've interact with your environment all the way up until seeing that ad. Like, a lot of ads are symbolic or a lot of ads are metaphorical, and unless you have lived something that's similar, then you're not going to be able to relate to that.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think a lot of it is built around memory cues and mental cues and experiences you've had throughout your life, and that's why advertising means different things to different people, because everyone has a very different experience.
So the story is within yourself, kind of thing.
Yeah,
you're extracting the story from the person looking at it.
Indeed.
Well, yeah, you're definitely leaving a piece of your own kind of experience onto that particular campaign. I mean, I think that's why great creative directors kind of excel in that regard, because it's not just they've seen something and then they've materialized it. They've put their own spin on it based on their experience. I mean, that's my opinion.
Yeah.
So working at a market, studying, coming to Melbourne, starting your side hustle, and then also working at 9 to 5. Which one came first, working or the side hustle?
Working 9 to 5. I was just so happy to get a full-time job after studying for so many years. I went into this job full head of steam.
And was it mainly SEO focused, or was it more traditional?
It was SEO focused.
Okay, so how did you know how to do SEO at that time? Because they don't teach that shit at uni.
I didn't.
You faked that shit, didn't you?
It was an entry-level role, and I essentially started off being an assistant to a team.
Okay.
It was the enterprise team, so we looked after like the larger scale clients within the agency. Mm-hmm. At the moment, at that time, I didn't have any clients of my own, but I learned from the 4 or 5 people within my team, watch them day to day, and pretty much learn everything on the job.
Okay.
My university degree was more traditional marketing. They didn't even tell me what SEO was. So I like applied for this job and like, I know what that is. I just did a quick Google definition search. Search engine optimization. Okay, sorted. And then I learned everything else on the job, and I was lucky that I was in a place where I had a lot of guidance.
Yep.
And that first year when I was in Melbourne, I think it was 2016, beginning of 2016, was probably one of the best years of my life. Like, I learned so much in such a little time and got to experience so much. And
talk us through that. I don't want to call it a plunge, because it wasn't a kind of stop start. It was more of an organic thing where you went from having a job to quitting and then one of your clients hitting you up wanting you to do work. But how did that feel like when you left that job and then one of your clients hit you up to say, hey, look, I want you to work to still carry on this job? Just talk us through that small part.
At the time, I didn't actually feel that I was that good at my job, to be honest. You know, I set really high standards of myself and the work that I do, and I always aspire to be as good as I can be. And I looked at some of the work that's more of the top people within that agency were putting out, and I thought, oh yeah, that's great, like, but I'm not at that level.
Yep.
So when this client approached me and said, I want to continue working with you, that really struck a chord. I'm like, oh, like, maybe I'm doing a good job. And that kind of sparked something in me that I could be like, okay, I could do this full time, or I could do more of this. And yeah, it just kind of grew from there. So started getting people find out about what I was doing and refer me on. And
yeah, so how did that happen? Did you leave and then he got in touch with you, or was it more of a, hey, look, I'm leaving, and then he kind of carried on the conversation to go, yeah, that's fine, I'm still gonna hire you?
I told him that I was leaving, told all my clients that I was leaving, and then he sent me a text, I reckon like 2-3 days later. And
yeah,
I hadn't even thought about doing freelance workout from there. And yeah.
But how did that make you feel when you got that text to go, all right, I've just quit this job, my ex line got in touch with me? I mean, I know you just described it before, but I want to dig in a bit deeper. Like, when you received that text, surely that would have been really cool.
Yeah, it was really
to read
cool. Yeah.
At the time.
At that moment I was really shocked. And then from there, you know, when you just start processing everything and your head just unlocks all these opportunities and you start thinking 5 years, 10 years later down the track, I kind of had that moment.
You're like, those market days, I'm a long way.
Man, all those times picking potatoes, I'm a long way from the farm in Virginia now.
People want me to do work for them now. Yeah.
Well, I can imagine that like uncontrollable smile at that moment.
Yeah.
But I guess the daunting moment from there would be, how much do I charge?
Yeah.
What? How did that sort of go? I guess I don't need a figure of how much you charge. It's more so how did you then process that? Like, I don't know what the company was charging. This guy's asking me for work now. Like, how did that?
I did know what the company was charging, and I was just that excited to get started that I just offered a monthly fee that was dramatically less than what he was being charged. But I knew that the amount of time that I could do with only one client, that the effort and obviously the outcome was going to be stronger than that. So it was improving on it both ways. It was going to be cheaper and it was going to be better quality work.
Totally.
And to be honest, because he was so loyal to me, I've still worked with Alex even to this day.
Yeah, wow.
And for the last 4 years, he's had the exact same rate.
Awesome.
We've just been work, because like, it was just a trust thing. We've actually built a really good relationship out of it.
That's
good,
brilliant,
friends,
man.
As well.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just a really good opportunity.
So how many clients have you got at the moment that you're doing frequent work for?
At the moment, we're in between 15 and 20 clients.
Okay, so you say we. Have you started
so like
working with other people to help you out?
Yes, so SEO is managed by myself, and I've also got my partner who looks after paid search and Facebook marketing.
Oh, wow, okay.
So we're partners in two things. We're partners in this, in Aperitive, and we're partners in life. So
yeah, wow.
We've been dating for just over 2 years.
All right. I want to tap into that a little bit soon.
Go on.
But because I can definitely relate, and I could probably learn from you as well. When you obviously got Alex as a client, what was that mindset like? Did you start thinking, because you did say you started thinking of all these other kind of opportunities out there, mm-hmm. and what you can kind of tap into. Was the first instinct to go out there and get another client, or did you want to make sure that Alex is well looked after? You can create some sort of a launch pad before you're comfortable enough to start looking for other clients.
Yeah, definitely. You want to make sure that you have that basis of what works first, build your processes and get that all set up correctly first.
Yep.
I didn't look for any new clients for like the first year and a half. I wanted to make sure that I really got that nailed and really made sure that I was kind of scalable.
Mm-hmm.
I did have some clients that were referred on to me, and then it just kind of grew from there. Like I said, at this point, we haven't gone out and actually looked for any clients head on. A lot of them have just come from referrals. And I think that gives you the breathing space to be able to make sure that your portfolio size is manageable at that point.
Sure.
Before you take on more. So we've always grown in that sense.
Yep. And obviously working at that job where you met Alex, you've had a few other jobs, and recently something kind of took place where you had to kind of figure things out, where mm-hmm. both you and Luke were working at that particular place.
Yeah.
We won't say the name of it, but obviously you're no longer working there anymore because a lot of people were made kind of mm-hmm. let go and what have you. What did that look like once you received that news and you weren't able to kind of maintain mm-hmm. that 9 to 5, obviously no fault of yours, but did that give you a bit more fuel in terms of the side hustle and what you wanted out of it?
It did, because it reminded me that when you're employed, your destiny is always in somebody else's hands.
Mm.
You know, like at that point in that role, I was quite proud of the work that I put forth, and actually feel that year and a half, whatever it was that I was there, was some of the best work of my career, particularly because of the resource restrictions and I was the only person in my role.
Yep.
I was quite happy with what I put forth, and I thought, even though I've done the best I possibly could with what I'm given, I still wasn't there or wasn't employed for much longer than what I wanted to be anyway.
Sure. So, and that was your second job in Melbourne?
That was my third.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. When working with Luke.
Yep.
Yeah.
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 So that was a bit of a spark to say, okay, eventually I want to be in control of my own destiny and I want to be able to know that I'm in a stable position and I can do this ongoing.
Yeah.
I totally agree. That job was, it was like crazy and hectic and like it's putting out fires every single day, but it somehow put a fire in me.
Yeah.
I had the fire the whole time. I had the potential for the fire, I think. It just wasn't lit yet.
Mm.
And then it lit it, and that's how like Jewel of Dove started, like while I was there. Like it was just like well before the redundancy, like fuck it, we're gonna do something.
Yeah.
Like,
well, that's the thing. That's when you and I started getting a bit more serious about starting this podcast. I did realize there was a fire that came out of nowhere. I'm like, man, Luke won't stop calling me. My phone keeps going off. What on earth is going on with this dude? And he told me the news.
Yeah.
And then he obviously, that's how you guys kind of bonded over what had happened.
Yeah, we didn't really get to collaborate much. No. We didn't really collaborate much before. Yeah. Right? But, it's really that when that started.
But see, it's amazing how life works, because you both were at a disadvantaged place, but then you kind of came together and you're like, cool, what now? When we're cornered,
yeah,
irrespective of what you do, like human beings are freaking powerful, man.
Right. Like it was ended up being, to be honest, a blessing in disguise. You know, that point onwards, the most accelerated growth that we've had with Aperitif was from that point, essentially.
Wow.
Because then we started saying yes to a lot more clients, had a lot more time. And then here we are.
Yeah.
So
I think it was just funny how you think that your path's already set, then God has a plan, and before you know it, you think this is probably the worst thing that could happen, losing your job. But then a month later, God provides and you're in a perfect place.
How did you mentally deal with that? I mean, kind of having a steady job and then all of a sudden not having it anymore.
Mm.
I mean, whilst you've still got your side hustle, but obviously it's not up to that point where you can do it full time because you're still growing the business.
Mm-hmm.
Mentally, how did you deal with that?
Mentally, it was tough because you feel like you're not good enough, even though you've done everything you possibly could. So at first it was pretty rough. But then started interviewing at places and actually were progressing in the interview stage at roles that were on par, if not more senior than what I was doing. And maybe I'm not as crap as what I thought it was. You always take it to heart at first.
Absolutely.
But over time, I feel like that kind of washed away. And then once I got my role at Airwallex, which was, to be honest, not very long after, that all kind of washed away.
Your confidence just went right back up and you're like, fuck that place.
Yeah. And I was like, what was I thinking? And I think my partner and I stayed. So Isabel was in that role as well. So my partner.
Oh, wow. Okay. And she was in the marketing team as well.
Yeah.
Did you guys meet?
We came across at the same time.
Oh, wow.
It was a bit of a hiring kind of phase when they brought on a lot of people and they needed someone in my role, someone in her role. So we both came on at the same time. But
Just a little segue. I totally forgot. Joe and Isabel used to work with Sean.
Yeah.
Oh.
Sean was on the podcast.
Yes.
Which episode was Sean on?
Hey, Sean.
I can't remember.
Listening.
It was like 5 or something.
We used to work with Sean as well.
See, this is like
what a small world.
Inception stuff going on.
Yeah.
So did you and your partner meet?
Was Mindshare, right?
We didn't meet there. We actually have worked together for 3 jobs in a row.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. So when the...
Okay, like that wasn't planned.
I don't know. Partly planned, partly not planned. We met in my first role at the first agency I worked with when I moved to Melbourne.
Yeah.
At that point, we're just friends. And then she left to go to Mindshare to be in Sean's team. And like, we were just really close friends. But take me with you, take me with you. And she ended up referring me on. I got the role.
Wow.
And then we were just really close friends at Mindshare as well. And then blossomed into a relationship during that period.
Awesome.
And then this opportunity came up in the role after that. And then the recruiter said, I'm also looking for someone that does SEM. And I'm like, I know the perfect person.
Wow.
So we both moved across. So it was, three roles in a row.
That's incredible. Shout out to Sean Polidano. He's an amazing dude.
He's
a big-ass personality. He's awesome. So we love him. All right. I did say I'm going to U-turn back.
Sure.
To that question.
Which one?
You working with your partner.
Yep.
Talk me through that, man. Because I'm in the same boat.
Yeah.
And I want to find out how that balance works.
Well, you guys had a double dose, right? So it was like working in the salary role, like in the 9 to 5 and on the side hustle. So it's like work.
Yeah.
It's like double.
Don't get me wrong. It has its challenges at times, you know.
Are you going to get in trouble answering some of these questions?
No, I'll speak honestly. Like, she knows we speak about. That's one of the things that makes it work well, is you have to be able to tell each other something when it's not working.
You've got
to
be very transparent.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And like, if we weren't so close prior to us being together, I think that would have been a bigger problem than what it was. But because we started off as best friends, then it's like going to work with your best friend every day. So it didn't become a problem. Like we kind of got through it and it was fine. We actually looked forward to it. But sometimes it did cause some friction when you're just like, man, I just like need some time to myself to think. Because I'm quite a solo person by nature.
Okay.
So at that point when you're commuting together, going to work together, having lunch together, going home, having dinner together.
So she's still with you at Air Wallachs as well?
No. So from when we left our previous role, we've gone our different ways.
Okay. I guess that makes it somewhat easier to work after hours.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So when you guys are approached with a client and you need to come up with a strategy, paid and organic, how does that interaction look like?
So we kind of divvy up the work at first and say, Isabel, come together with the SEM strategy because she's the expert in the field. I'm not going to come in and say this is what we should be doing.
Sure.
So she'll come to the table with what she thinks from an SEM perspective. I'll come to the table from an SEO perspective. And then from there, the last couple of stages are really meshing that together and make sure that it sings.
So
this is pre-contract, like pre-understanding the budget for the month and stuff like that?
Yeah, so this is pre-contract. So
what
we do really well is we provide our pitch prior to signing the contract. So you know exactly, like we've done the research already in terms of what we think is going to work. Here's the research that backs it. Here are the keywords we should be targeting.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's a lot easier to show the client and win that trust when you say, look, we've already done the work. We just need your okay. Here's the fee, and then you start from there.
Yeah.
So what I want to know is when do you guys switch off from working and then going back to the relationship side of things? So like the actual personal stuff as opposed to the business stuff.
Sure.
Is there a switch that's off and on, or is it constantly on? Yeah. What does that look like? Talk me through that.
Just a little bit of context, because Omar doesn't want to talk about it. Omar and his wife Nikita have a label together.
Nice.
So they're like they're in a similar position.
Okay.
Yeah, a fashion label. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So just to give you some context. Yeah.
Okay. Good to know. So when we were employed together, we were very much professional only. Like a lot of people didn't actually know that we were together. When we went to work, we just did our work, and that was it. When it comes to Aperitif, it's at home. Whenever the laptops are open, it's almost like you just make that switch naturally and become the professional partnership rather than the relationship partnership.
Yeah.
And I think over time, because we've been doing it so long, it just kind of came naturally.
It just clicks.
We didn't really speak about it and say this is what we're going to do. I think both working in the same places for so long, that kind of just morphed into something.
Mm. But surely you're about to. You're in bed, you're about to turn over and like shut your eyes to go to sleep. And then she might say something about work. And you're like, man, that's the last thing I want to hear right now. I'm trying to get some sleep.
It happens.
Not speaking from experience. That was just a random question.
It happens a lot. Like, my eyes are like closed. I'm just like, oh, you should think about targeting this. I'm like, oh, I don't really. Yeah, I'm like, I just go like this. And I think she's really very good at reading me when I want to have those conversations. Yeah. And when I'm just grunting, she's like, yeah, okay. Oh, this is a tomorrow question.
But what they're saying is valid, though. At yes, that time, it is very valid.
It's just the wrong timing.
You've just ran out of fucks for the day.
Yes.
Do you have like a process? Like, is there like a joint notebook, like digital notebook or something where you guys can like put those ideas to discuss tomorrow or something like that? Or you just on the strength of...
I wish. That's actually a really good idea. Thanks for that. WhatsApp, really. We just like send each other ideas at all hours of the day. And right now, it's probably something we want to be working on a lot better. But we probably set a cutoff time around 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. From that, and it's just like laptop down on most occasions. Mm. And then it's just like, okay, we need to switch off for the day.
That's good.
You need to have that balance. Otherwise, you're just going to go... nuts.
Cool, man.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks for answering that. I would answer that. Definitely. Whatever. It's a story for another day.
Maybe we should swap seats and I'll ask you the questions.
Exactly. I want to get back to you and how you mentally kind of segregate your 9 to 5 and coming back home to work on Apparitive and work with your partner on Apparitive. What is that look like for Joe, and what's working, what's not working, you know? Just kind of talk me through that a little bit.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, like having a side hustle is time consuming. That you need to be able to make sacrifices and be able to know that you're going to be working a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no way around it, unfortunately, sometimes.
So there
are times when it gets easier, but I think what you can do that works really well, or what I do that works well, is try to set blocks of time.
Sure.
So I make it pretty clear with my role that I don't like taking work home.
Mm.
So once I've left for the day, then that's pretty much...
You've checked out as soon as you're out the door, boom.
Pretty much, yeah. Yep. Like obviously if there's something urgent or something that's an emergency, jump to it. But I try to like set those boundaries.
Sure.
Does that work for like Slack and stuff like that as well? Like people know not to Slack you after hours? Or...
Yeah, I just mute it after like 6:30 p.m. And if it's a direct message to me, I'll get a notification and then screen it if it's important, or if it's something that can wait to the next day, I'm sure like it can wait if it's just a discussion or something like that.
Definitely.
So I just set my time up in blocks and know that once I get home, then it's Apparitive work for certain days of the week, like Mondays, Wednesdays, and one day of the weekend are pretty much all gone to Apparitive apart from hours here and there.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Like I still try and play sport as well. So like I play soccer for a club. We train twice a week.
Oh, shit, you play soccer? I don't even know that.
Yeah.
Because I'm a footballer too.
Nice.
And you can't say soccer, by the way. It's football.
It is football, you know? But I think that soccer has Italian. Greater cut through.
You got that's the Aussie coming out. Yeah.
When in Rome, you got to speak like the Romans. So
definitely.
That's kind of a good release, and it means that I can just think about football for 6 hours a week or so.
Yeah, the reason why I asked that question is whilst you have your processes and you've got time blocked out, and on paper it looks, organized and tidy, and you're prepared. But mentally, not every day you're going to come back home and have that same motivation to go, all right, I've just finished a solid 8-hour day where I've, you know, catered to clients, I've done this, I've done that, and I got to sit down and do this other thing
for another 5 hours or so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sometimes so how do you...
You have to though sometimes.
You have to.
You've got
a deadline, like you've committed.
That's it. Absolutely, there's a responsibility there. When someone's paying you and someone's expecting something of you, then you... Most times you don't have a choice.
Sure. So it's a deadline and the money that's kind of in the back of your head, and obviously delivering something to that specific person. Mm-hmm. You don't want to let them down.
Yeah.
I think it's a relationship.
Indeed.
It's a relationship.
Yeah. You've built this trust. You've promised something to someone. They're paying you a fee to do so.
Yep.
And that's basically like, that's what builds the relationship.
So that supersedes that supersedes any kind of, feeling of not necessarily remorse, but you're tired, you can't be bothered. Mm-hmm. It supersedes all that, and you're just like, boom, I'm focused. Yeah. Relationship comes first. That's very big of you, man. I definitely appreciate that.
Thanks. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, there are tough days, but when you think about the people that have entrusted in you, and like I'm thankful for all the clients that I have, they're able to help me build my business in terms of what I want it to be. So I see it as they're doing me a favor as much as I am helping them out. So you don't want to let them down. And then from a motivation perspective, you always think about the end goal and what you're working towards.
Yep.
And that's to have a happy and safe and stable future with your family. You know, that's kind of the end motivation for me, is being able to work remotely or work from home and spend time with your kids and not be like a distant parent, you know.
Have you got kids?
No, not yet. But okay. when we do make that
absolutely
step,
yes.
Right now I'm making the foundation so that I can have a happy family.
No, you know, respect, like, man.
Yeah, definitely.
For a large part of my life, I grew up with just my mum and my brother. When your mum's trying to feed you both, she's at work for a lot of that time. So it's really tough growing up, essentially for that period of time on your own.
Yeah. So, I mean, being a migrant family, coming from a tough time at that, you know, when did your grandparents migrate?
I think it was late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. So kind of, when was that? No, World War II would have been like 1945 or something. But anyways, there were some recessions around there. And coming in as a migrant family, not understanding the culture, the language.
Yeah.
And then you're a mother, you're on your own, you're trying to look out for two boys. I definitely commend you. You've definitely got a different lens at looking at that. You're trying to change that perspective or that experience you've gone through and kind of just loop it around and just be like, hey, mom, look, this is what I'm doing. It's a pride thing in the end of the day, yeah?
It is a pride thing, and it's a pride thing that you want to do for your parents and grandparents too. Like, they came here for a better life, and I feel that I owe it to them, who always did their best to give the best for me and my brother. And, you know, you kind of... You want to do well to make them proud. And they tell me all the time, though, I'm proud of you and stuff like that. And it does mean a lot. And it's always, that's motivation itself, or it's fuel to kind of push you on and make sure that you continue doing what you're doing. You can't kind of just sit on your hands like, oh, like I've done X, Y, Z. You know, it doesn't end just because you feel that you've accomplished something. You know, there's always, always more to do.
And I think it's also hard to turn it off as well.
Yes.
Like, there's just something, like, from my personal side, there's just something in me where I can't turn it off. Like, I just finished a freelance job, invoice was just paid, and I've got a couple of different things bubbling, which always seems to happen. Like, it's like one thing ends and then these calls come in and it all sort of happens nice and organically. But in the interim, I'm just like designing, I was saying, telling Omar before, I really like Casio watches. So I'm just designing, I'm putting this out into the world now because I want it to happen. I'm designing just like faces for them. I made a template, like a vector template. Now I'm designing faces, coming to a Casio collab and have my version, and then they give me a watch and it's mine.
Nice.
But I just can't turn it off. Like, I just need to be doing something. Like, and it seems like you have a similar mentality as well.
Yeah.
Like, can you speak to that as well? Like, how do you feed that nonstop hunger that is sort of like, it's just there?
You just have to keep your hands busy, unfortunately. But even if it's something like, if I'm not working with a client, then I'm reading blogs or reading... With SEO, you have to kind of keep up with the latest trends and see what algorithm changes have happened. So even when I'm not deep in client work, you're kind of upskilling and trying to learn new things as well to make sure that you can pull that back into your job and make yourself better.
Yeah.
So I actually want to learn to code more efficiently. So, like, I know a bit of HTML and stuff like that, but I want to learn programming and then eventually be able to build something that can change the world, is the end plan, right? I think, like you said, Luke, it doesn't really turn off. You just have to find what you do that you enjoy and something that's applicable to other areas of your life and trying to mesh them all together.
So talking about kind of future development, what's the future looking like for Apparative? Where do you and Elizabeth see it going?
So we're still...
Isabel.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm horrible with names. I'm so sorry. Isabel, I'm sorry. Shout out to Isabel.
At the moment, we're just focusing on basically doing the work to a high standard, letting that speak for itself.
Yep.
We're not
in a rush to...
No.
...kind of, you know, get more clients and employ more people. You're kind of just steady on trying to... do what you do best.
Yeah.
And do the best quality work.
I think when you start to hound clients that aren't necessarily a good fit for you or don't necessarily need the services that you offer, you're not going to do work that's going to have a standard that's going to be have longevity. You know, I want to find clients that we're going to be working with for a long time, build relationships that are on a business perspective and on a personal perspective as well. Because that's when you do your best work. So we're not actively going out to grab clients. Don't get me wrong, we'll take on any clients that want to come through that are a good fit.
Sure.
But at this stage, we're really just focusing on how can we make our work more efficient? How can we get the best results? And then from there, it will grow organically. Which organic search, grow organically.
Hey.
Great connection there. So, yeah.
No. That definitely seems like more your speed. You're not the type of dude who's looking to expand for the sake of expanding.
Indeed.
And it's not focused on the business side. I mean, the business side is still very important, but it seems to me that you're more focused on the relationship and actually providing a service that's worth talking about.
Yes.
Where people can refer you and there's substance, there's depth, and there's like, hey, when your name is brought up, it needs to be attached to that reputation, right?
Right. Mm. And like SEO agencies and digital agencies are a dime a dozen in Melbourne now. You know, what's going to be your differentiating point is something that I think about a lot. Like, what am I going to do differently that the 100 other agencies in Melbourne don't do? And I think this is something that has worked really well and something that I want to refine and build over the next few years and make sure that this is a business that's stable and that's going to keep clients for a long period of time. Don't get me wrong, we'll still have churn. We'll still lose clients due to any sort of thing, budget constraints, change in focus or anything like that.
Yep.
But
yep.
on the most part, you want to be working with people for a long period of time because SEO takes time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of SEO agencies will tell you, oh, I'll get you on page one in 60 days or 90 days or it's free or anything like that. And those gimmicks, unfortunately, don't work, you know. SEO takes time. You need to put the effort in. You need to put the research in and build it up over time. But then once you're there, like, it can change a business because you're not necessarily paying for every visitor that comes through to your website.
It's like for lack of better examples, it's taking medication. You need to kind of keep taking it for you to feel the effects of it.
Yeah, vitamins.
That too.
Yeah.
So
does that mean
it's not going to happen instantly? It's not going to happen overnight, but there's still a fair bit of education to those that you're providing the services to that, hey, look, this is something that we've got to keep chipping away at and literally optimizing time after time at a frequent, you know, pace.
Yeah, so it needs maintenance.
For us to get the result.
It needs maintenance once you
it
get
needs
there,
love.
Right? Like once you get to page one, you don't stay there, right? Like you need
to maintain it, yeah.
Yeah.
And the best part about it is when you're a startup or when you're a small business, you don't have thousands of dollars to throw at marketing every month. So chipping away at it each month means that once we're there, we're getting free traffic each month and it's incremental.
Yeah.
So free leads and stuff like that, or apart from just the cost of the work that goes into it, that can turn a business around or change a business. You know, once you start having a website that generates leads on a regular basis without just being correlational to the amount of money that you're spending, that's can be life-changing.
Because you're kind of making content that's just there forever, right?
Like, yeah, evergreen.
Content. Yeah, yeah.
The work that you do with SEO is always evergreen. Like, it's always going to be there longer than just the initial input of you spending the money and then that's it. And then, like, for example, with Google AdWords, you buy a click or something like that, and if they don't convert, then you don't convert with the remarketing, that's the end of it. But with SEO, you're always kind of building out and growing on what you've done in the past.
Sure.
Yeah, cool.
And do you and your partner share the same vision in terms of what Apparitive is all about and where you guys are heading?
Yes. Our vision is mainly conjoint in the family aspect.
Mm.
You know, like when you're a professional, you tend to sacrifice a lot of hours, particularly when you plan on having a family and stuff like that. You know, you're working long hours, and we both really want to be there for our kids.
Absolutely.
We both really want to be a tight-knit family because that's what's important to us from a value perspective.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And that's where this all stems from, is trying to create a foundation where we can have that, where you can only go and see clients 1 or 2 days a week and work from home and spend a lot of that time with your kids and watch
them
grow up and have those moments together.
Mm.
Whereas, unfortunately, by default in our culture, we don't have that.
No.
The culture is work until 7 p.m. at night, come home, see your kid for an hour, have dinner, put them to bed and stuff like that.
Yep.
And I don't think that's a great way to grow up.
That sounds depressing the way you've just put it.
Well, the crazy thing about that is that's not really reality in the sense of I'm really lucky I get to finish work at 4 o'clock. By the time I get home, I have about an hour and a half, max 2 hours. But if you finish work at 7, you're not going to see your kids. Like, they'll be long gone.
Asleep. When you're speaking from experience, I'm speaking like philosophically.
You know,
you're there.
Yeah, so I totally feel what you're saying. Like, I'm my my strategy at the moment is thinking about how do I want to figure out a way where I can earn money in from multiple sources.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to stop working. I want to work, but I want to have different things each day where I can just do what I need to do each day, but then have time throughout the day as well. Like this morning I had a user interview at 10 o'clock, which meant, and I went straight from home to the user interview, which means I got to drop the kids off at daycare. So me and my wife dropped the kids off together, and just like that little moment was just so nice to be able to drop them off and just have that moment. I'm not going to see them tonight because we're doing this, but now I've had that moment. So it kind of makes up for a little bit, balances the day a little bit because I didn't really get to see them 2 hours in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And just somehow just make it work. Like in the morning, my kids get up early, like 5 a.m. And a lot of the time it's like, fuck, it's 5 a.m., man.
Which game do you want to play first? Do you want to play this, Dad? Or do you want to play this?
but realistically, it's a good thing because it means I get to see them for a couple of hours in the morning before I leave. So it kind of just works out really well and you figure out how to balance it. I wanted to circle back a little bit. You mentioned before, we kind of glazed over it, but you mentioned when you go to these pitch meetings, you have the research done, you have a bit of a strategy ready to go. How does that look in the terms of like winning clients, like missing a client? Like, is there ever any feeling of, man, we did all this work and then you didn't go with us, like that they might use like, you know, your strategy? Like, how does that sort of play out a little bit?
Yeah, good question. We feel that whenever we want to go into a pitch or whenever you want to try and win a client, we're going to give it everything we've got and give it the best possible chance so you leave nothing on the table and you know that it's not down to the quality of work that you hope anyway.
Yeah.
It is time consuming to do so, but from the experiences we've had, even prior to that, like working at agencies and stuff like that, we feel that when we're really prepared and when you've done the research, your conversion rate's a lot higher.
Okay.
So you just need to account for that time if you want to have a great conversion rate. And to be honest, from the proposals that we put out, we're closing probably 70% of those. So it's like
that's a pretty good hit rate.
That's awesome.
So
yeah,
the time that goes into it, and when you can build that trust by doing so, and okay, these guys are actually willing to make the sacrifice and put in the effort. Because a lot of people or a lot of agencies would just say, well, we just do this and everyone's a nail, I'm a hammer, you're going to get this and this.
It's just like stock standard services.
Indeed. And then you just listen to the pitch or listen to the presentation, it's the same thing. The next person comes in, tells you the same thing. Whereas if you make it relatable to their business, they can kind of visualize what's going on. It works really well. It's just, it's something that we have made that's, I'm sure other people do it as well, but that's what we feel works really well and we'll continue with it.
Yeah, awesome. So there's an element of there where you're also educating the client as well of what you guys are bringing, like what's about to happen.
Yeah, like every client is going to be different, and particularly working with small to medium enterprises, like, you know, not everyone has a huge knowledge of SEO. Some people want to know about it, some people don't. You kind of have to adjust your pitch and your strategy from that client and what they expect. So in my portfolio, I have some clients that don't want to know. They just want to see leads and they just want to see their business grow. And that's fine. We work with that as well. And we just tailor our reporting and our strategy and our pitch to that.
Mm-hmm.
I have other clients that want to know the ins and outs and learn a lot of that. And then you basically have to mold your strategy and your work to what they expect. So a lesson we've learned along the way is make sure that you tailor your pitch and your approach to your client.
Mm.
Because everyone has different expectations, everyone has different levels of knowledge, and you're going to have the greatest success when you're molding it to what they want and what they expect. Because at the same time, like if I could come in and speak to a new client and start talking about like metadata and backlinks and crawlability, robots, files, and like they're just like, I don't know what you're talking about. I just want to grow my business. So you don't want to isolate them in the same sense.
Absolutely.
You want to be approachable and show that you're there as their most trusted and most valuable business partner.
That's awesome, because SEO has been such a cliche term that people throw around, but it's awesome that you hold yourself to a really high standard and how you pitch yourself, because it's all about understanding what the pain points are and what your marketing plans are. And if you don't have any marketing plans, let us in so we can develop those for you.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's just that trust factor. So I think, I mean, you're sitting here talking to Luke and I, you're a very genuine person. I can tell off the bat. And I'm assuming that's the same way that you are in front of your clients. What you see is what you get.
Yeah, 100%. And that builds trust. So that means a lot. Thank you.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I couldn't fault you. Please hire this guy. He's such a nice dude.
Thanks.
We're starting to wrap up here a little bit. And what I wanted to know personally, I mean, obviously, you've spoken a lot about your grandparents and working at the markets and stuff. So you've had people that have somewhat mentored you by default. Mm-hmm. But have you had any mentorship with the side hustle that you've got at the moment? Is there anyone that you can kind of lean on for advice or that you see on a regular basis?
To be honest, not really. Like, I lean on Isabel a lot and we bounce ideas off each other in terms of what we think will work for particular clients from a business perspective as well. But unfortunately not. Like, I have a lot of mentors in life, but not necessarily that are business related.
Sure.
Like, I've got three aunts who are godsends, like three fairy godmothers, and they guide me from a life perspective, in terms of keeping me on a nice moral straight standpoint road.
Italian aunties, you can't go wrong, man.
Yeah, I'm lucky. There's obviously my parents as well. They've taught me a lot from a business perspective. But other than that, I wouldn't say that I've had a hard mentor.
Sure.
Like, family-wise, like I said, we grew up pretty working class. And even to this day, my parents don't really know what I do.
Yeah,
they just know I do something with computers. That's what they tell people, something in marketing, something with computers. And that's kind of...
But I'm sure they're very proud of you, though.
They are proud of me, yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad...
Hey, Isabel, by the way, I set him up for that question because he just said that you're his mentor. So that makes up for my mess up earlier.
Yeah, brownie points.
Like I said, we're just starting to wrap up, man. I mean, unfortunately, we've got to get out of this place. I've really enjoyed having you here and talking to you. You're an awesome dude and you've got a head on your shoulders and obviously putting family at the forefront of everything you do and setting up yourself. I mean, no one can be mad at that, but respect it. Do you have any kind of last words or anything you want to share with our audience, someone who's in your position or someone who's kind of wanting to take that leap of starting their own thing?
I think the biggest lesson that you can learn is find what you do really well. Like, find your own unique thing that you bring to the table and hone in on that and really do it well, and everything else will fall into place. Don't try and do everything at once. Don't try and be an expert at everything. Just try and find your place and what drives you, and that the rest of it will come easy.
From there it's
a lot easier to see the goal and what you're working towards.
I definitely agree. Right. I think just taking your time and just being patient with it, not putting pressure on yourself. Yep, absolutely. Luke, is there anything else you wanted to add to that? Because you're obviously in the same boat with freelancing and everything.
I feel the same. I feel like I've learned lots of things from this discussion. Lots of things about you, Joe, as well. It's been awesome. Like, there's also this like thing that I've been thinking about lately of like, when is enough in terms of like monetary value. Like, at the end of the day, I started off my career wanting to, I guess, like the glitz of design, like wanting to be in every meeting, everywhere, be respected and admired and all that sort of stuff. And I'm kind of starting to realize now, like, who cares about, like, well, more bluntly, who gives a fuck about that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
Because like, the family is the most important thing. Indeed. And then also then on the other side of that is, how much money do we actually need? Like, I feel like I'm in this cycle and I keep freelancing for like fun money and all this sort of stuff. And am I just wasting money and just chill out of it and that sort of stuff? And I just feel like all this sort of stuff sort of relates, and just trying to just keep the work, do the work hard and stick back to my core. Like,
that's it.
Like, how you're sticking back to your SEO sort of roots. I'm sticking back to design.
Sort
of like sticking to that. And I'm really looking forward to collaborating with you. We've been talking about how we can collaborate in the future.
For sure.
There's going to be like a really good collaboration starting to form, I think.
It's going to be amazing. Hey, man, we can't thank you enough for taking time out of your Friday evening. It's been awesome getting to know you.
Plug yourself first.
Oh, yes, okay. That too. Yes.
Sure thing. So aperitif.agency, aperitif.agency. If you need any help with SEO, SEM, feel free to drop us a line through the website and the contact form. And if you're a listener of this podcast, we'll look after you especially well.
Oh, boom. There you go. Any socials?
No socials.
No
socials. At the moment, word of mouth and website has only been going for like the last 6 months. So hit us up.
We'll give it to that. Like I was saying, man, thank you so much for giving up your time. Luke and I definitely appreciate it. And we can't wait to share this episode with our listeners.
Thanks so much.
Can't wait. Awesome.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you.